Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, France 24, NHK Japan, and Radio Havana Cuba. We will begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. As of today, Trump has made a deal with the European Union for a 15% tariff on goods sent to the U.S., with some important exceptions. A DW correspondent, Christine Mundwa, explained some of the criticism from European countries and the questions of the legality of these tariffs under WTO trading rules. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
But now it's back to golf for the U.S. president. He's wrapping up his 5-day visit to Scotland today by meeting the country's first minister and attending the opening of a new Trump golf course. It's been a busy trip for the U.S. president, with Trump meeting U.K. Prime Minister Keir Starmer. He also weighed in on what he called real starvation in Gaza and Russia's war on Ukraine, as we just heard. On Sunday, he signed a major new trade deal with the EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. The agreement slaps a 15% tariff on goods entering the United States coming from the EU. And that trade deal has received a lukewarm response from some EU member states. For more, we can cross over to Brussels, where our correspondent Christine Mundwa is standing by for us. Christine, what are the critics of this deal saying?
Well, lukewarm is a very nice way of putting it, Nicole, in terms of the criticism that this deal has gotten from quarters here in the European Union. I mean, you've got some people saying that the one side got a deal and the other got a bill, because what this deal does is it sees the European Union paying a 15% baseline tariff on its exports to the United States. In exchange, the U.S. gets more access to the EU market, and it's pretty much made no concessions for that, potentially more revenue as well for the United States. And so people are saying, what if that, if it's not surrender or capitulation? On top of that, Brussels promises to ramp up investment in the United States to the tune of 600 billion euros, and then a promise to buy more energy from the United States to the tune of 750 billion over the next 3 years. So it is really looking like Brussels did surrender to the United States. And just given where we were at the start of negotiations, Brussels was initially offering zero for zero tariffs. And then at some point, it looked like they were going to land on zero for 10% tariffs, with some exceptions for certain sectors like cars, for example. Then came that weekend letter from the U.S. president threatening a 30% tariff if there was no deal reached by the 1st of August. So here is where we are today. Huge criticism coming from a number of quarters on this deal with the United States.
This was negotiated by the European Commission. What are they saying in defense of the deal?
Well, the Commission president says that the alternatives were not better, right? I talked about that 30% threat that the U.S. president threatened by 1st of August. This would have been in a few days from now. And the current tariff level is at about 27.5%. So 15% does seem like the better option. Then there's also the practical reality that Brussels just cannot afford a trade war with the United States for both economic and political reasons, right? Brussels right now needs to keep Washington on board when it pertains to staying the course for support for Ukraine. And so you saw the Commission consistently extend the olive branch throughout these negotiations, even when you could see that the United States perhaps wasn't negotiating in a goodwill manner. You saw the Commission repeatedly soften its approach, opting not to impose retaliatory measures. And critics, like in France, chief among them the French President Emmanuel Macron, were saying that Brussels should have been tougher from the very start, should have been more open to imposing retaliatory tariffs. But this is where we are today. the commission saying there was no better deal, this was the option, and the uncertainty was bad for businesses on both sides of the Atlantic, but it's certainly for this side of the Atlantic. And we see, for instance, in Berlin, the German chancellor saying this is good for an export-oriented economy like Germany, because that uncertainty over ongoing negotiations is taken off the table now.
Briefly, can you tell us if there is a chance that the detractors could still derail this deal?
Well, Nicole, that's a very interesting aspect, because there are questions about the legality of this, right? So you've got to look at the concessions that the European Union has made. And once the dust settles and we have more clarity about what's really in this deal, we'll understand whether or not these concessions are in line with the WTO's trading rules. Because if the United States has now been given some sort of preferential access to the EU market, you're violating international trade laws. So you might have the legal aspect of that. But then there's also the practicality factor, right? Does the European Union or EU member countries really have the scope to ramp up energy imports from the US by 750 billion euros over the next 3 years? Also, the Commission cannot guarantee that 650 billion of investment into the United States, because that's not public spending, that is private sector spending, which the EU Commission does not have control over. So it'll be interesting to see how practically this deal will come out in the end, given the opposition.
A deal on the table, but many questions remain. That was DW correspondent Christine Mundwa in Brussels. Thanks so much.
That analysis was from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary, and most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. Next, France 24. First, some European press reviews about the U.S.-EU tariff deal. Then press on the UN conference on Gaza, which the U.S. and Israel boycotted. Arab nations urged Hamas to disarm and end its rule in Gaza, while Canada and France said that they will recognize Palestinian statehood. Meanwhile, the King of Jordan said that the Gaza crisis is the worst in modern history. The Trump administration says it will be rescinding the fact that greenhouse emissions endanger human health and will eliminate all U.S. regulations controlling them. An interview with Dan Becker, director of Safe Climate Transport Campaign, about the effects this could have on U.S. economy and the global environment. France 24.
Lots of reductions here in Europe. After that, U.S. tariffs deal was agreed upon with Donald Trump, Dipti.
Yeah, that's right. So that 15% U.S. tariffs on European goods entering the U.S., it has also committed, as Charles mentioned, to buy $750 billion worth of energy products and $600 billion in new investments. This is the reaction from the Belgian paper Le Soir, which calls it an indigestible agreement for Europe, at least. One thing is for clear, even if the details still need to be eked out, one thing is for clear, the European papers definitely see this as Europe being the big loser. Le Soir, in its editorial, says here that it's a ruinous deal for Europe and one that shows how far inadapted Europe's economic politics are, to the point that it cannot even defend itself from the US. Libération, the French left-wing paper, on its front page, publishing this extract or this headline from its interview with the French economy and finance minister Eric Lompard, who warns that the world has really recessed into a world of predators now. He says also that this deal is a loser-loser deal for all sides, noting that low tariffs benefit industries and consumers. But he calls this deal with the U.S. the best of all the worst options. And you have this rather sarcastic headline from Aujourd'hui en France, Le Parisien newspaper. 15% is at a mate's rate, it asks on its front page.
Start with reactions to that UN conference that was co-chaired by France and Saudi Arabia in New York that just wrapped up.
Yeah, that's right. That UN General Assembly brought together high-level officials earlier this week, co-chaired, as you said, by Saudi Arabia and France, notably their foreign ministers. It did not include Israel or the US, however, because both those nations boycotted the summit. The Independent here noting that one of the big conclusions from that summit was this: Arab nations urging Hamas to disarm and end its rule in Gaza in a bid to end the devastating war in the territory, a move described as unprecedented and a major shift for Arab nations. It also follows calls, of course, from the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer and now Canada's Mark Carney to recognize Palestinian statehood. Now, in Law and Le Jour, a French-language Lebanese paper, it looks really goes into detail about what that seven-page report from that summit entails. It includes a 15-month timeline for the creation of a Palestinian state, returning control of the enclaves to the Palestinian Authority, and then upon Egypt's suggestion, a plan to reboot the economy there with the injection of international funds to help rebuild Gaza.
Okay. Meanwhile, Deepshika, you've noticed that on the Arab news, the Saudi daily paper, they have the King of Jordan on the front page on the issue.
Yeah, they're quoting King Abdullah, as you see here, who said that the Gaza crisis is the worst in modern history. It comes, as you see there, after settlers cut off West Bank village water supply and dozens of Palestinians killed amid starvation that is pervading through the strip. In its editorial today, the paper says that countries should act unilaterally in recognizing Palestine and that it should not be an act of defiance but a pledge to uphold human dignity and end decades of suffering.
The Trump administration said this week that it would be rescinding the long-standing finding that greenhouse gas emissions endanger human health, removing the legal foundation for all American greenhouse gas regulations. Environmental groups have blasted the decision, saying it spells the end of the road for U.S. action against climate change, even as the impacts of global warming become more severe. The EPA proposal must go through a lengthy review process, including public comment, before being finalized likely next year. Well, for more, let's bring in Dan Becker. He's director of the Safe Climate Transport Campaign at the Centre for Biological Diversity. Thanks, Dan, for being with us on the programme this evening. It's called the 2009 Endangerment Finding. You describe that as the biggest single step any nation has taken to combat global warming. Just tell us exactly what that was and how it came to change our lives, American lives, for the better.
Actually, the biggest single step are the clean car rules that Trump announced also yesterday that he's rescinding. Those would cut 7 gigatons of carbon dioxide over the life of the vehicles being made. But the two of these go together in that the science determination has encouraged the government to take action against global warming pollution. And taking that away is doing an enormous favor for the oil industry, which funded Trump's campaign to the tune of $445 million. So this is payback. And it's a dreadful blow to those who want to combat global warming. The U.S. is the second biggest global warming emitter in the world after China. The consequences are huge. We're going to have to figure out a way to undo this, but it's going to be tough. One hope is that the Trump administration is going to have to go into courts and argue that the science behind global warming is bunk. And it's not. The world's leading scientists are on our side and demanding that we take action. So convincing a court, even a conservative one, that the science is a fraud is an uphill battle for the Trump administration. But we still have individual sources like automobiles, power plants, factories that have to be controlled. Otherwise, the U.S. will continue to guzzle and pollute and spew emissions.
And the Trump administration, it claims that these kind of regulations, these environmental regulations, they're too costly, they're overreaching. Why exactly, though, is this all happening now, in your view?
It's happening now because Trump won. A year ago, April, he served chopped steak to a bunch of oil CEOs at Mar-a-Lago and said, if you give me $1 billion for my campaign, I'll do anything you want. They gave him basically $445 million, and now he's doing the everything that they want. So all of the rollbacks on clean cars, on clean power, on renewable energy, all of that is at the behest of the oil industry and sometimes the auto industry. And it's having terrible consequences for the United States, including for American automakers who will lose their shirts to China because China is going to make clean vehicles. They don't have a Trump in office who denies the facts. And the Chinese have companies like BYD, which most Americans have never heard of, but Europeans are beginning to. They sold 4.5 million EVs last year, electric vehicles. And there's no place to go but up for the Chinese if the American manufacturers uniformly disarm, which is what they're invited to do by Trump.
These tariffs that Trump is announcing, cuts, other various policies, and really the uncertainty that all of this is creating, for example, in the geothermal industry and for other cleaner energy sources.
Well, I'm not a trade lawyer. I'm an environmental lawyer. And so I'm not an expert in the tariffs. They certainly are adding pressure to American companies at a time when American companies need to deal with the changes that Trump is throwing at them. They're also, of course, a challenge for companies that sell products to the United States. We want to buy clean vehicles. We want to buy clean energy. And to the extent that Trump is trying to prevent that from happening with 100% tariff, for example, on Chinese electric vehicles, that's a real problem both for the United States and for the rest of the world, because the atmosphere is a global commons. And whatever comes out in the United States circles the world and heats it.
That is Dan Becker, director of the Safe Climate Transport Campaign at the Center for Biological Diversity.
Those reports and interview were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English, and most podcast sites. On to NHK World Radio Japan. Cleanup of 880 tons of molten nuclear fuel and structures at the Fukushima nuclear power plant will not begin until the late 2030s at the earliest. A North Korean senior figure has dashed hopes of reunification as proposed by the new South Korean president. The upcoming Australian ban on social media for those under 16 will now include YouTube. NHK Japan.
Work to remove molten fuel debris from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant will likely commence years behind schedule. It won't start until the late 2030s at the earliest. Three of the plant's nuclear reactors melted down after a massive earthquake and tsunami in 2011. The facility is now in the process of being decommissioned, but an estimated 880 tons of debris still remains in the reactors. It consists of molten nuclear fuel and parts of the reactor structures themselves. Removing it is considered the biggest hurdle of the decommissioning process. The plant's operator, Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, aims to start with the debris in reactor number 3. There are plans to begin the work in the early 2030s. But after conducting studies on specific removal methods, TEPCO concluded it would take more time. They say the company will need 12 to 15 years just to prepare for the work. That's because TEPCO plans to build new facilities above reactor number 3 and try to reduce radiation levels. But that'll take longer than anticipated. The government and TEPCO were aiming to decommission the plant by 2051, 40 years after the accident. But several parts of their roadmap have now fallen behind schedule.
One of North Korea's most senior figures has dashed hopes of warmer ties on the Korean Peninsula. The sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un issued a strongly worded statement Monday, dismissing overtures from South Korean President Lee Jae-myung, who took office in June. She accused Seoul of showing blind trust in its alliance with the United States and claimed the South remains fundamentally confrontational toward the North. Lee's administration has taken a more conciliatory tone than the previous government. It's turned off the loudspeakers near the border in an effort to restart talks. But Kim brushed aside the gesture as meaningless, calling it just a reversal of something South Korea shouldn't have done in the first place. She condemned upcoming joint military exercises involving the U.S. and South Korea, saying there can be no change in the understanding of the enemy. She wrapped up by saying North Korea has no interest in any policy or proposal from Seoul, and there is no reason to meet for talks.
Australia said on Wednesday it will add YouTube to the list of platforms covered by its ban on social media use by children under 16. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese addressed the reasons for reversing a previous decision to exclude the video sharing service.
Social media companies have a social responsibility. That's why today we're pleased to announce that our government is tabling rules that specify which types of online services will be captured in our world-leading laws. We know this is not the only solution, and there's more to do, but it will make a difference.
From December, the ban will prohibit under-16s from creating a YouTube account, but will allow parents and teachers to show them videos. The Google-owned platform was not part of the original list of six major services, including Instagram, Facebook and TikTok, that were targeted over the issue of harmful content.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 10 p.m. at 13710 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. All the times they announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. NHK is also available at most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this program like a listener in New York City did this week, there is a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com. Or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever donated to this freely distributed show, keeping it up on the airwaves. Please, help if you can. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Activists have been gathering in the English city of Bristol to create a global Sumud flotilla, with dozens of boats leaving from different ports to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza. The airdrops of aid to Gaza have been ineffective and dangerous to the starving residents. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The atmosphere at the Malcolm X Center in the English city of Bristol is charged with purpose. Activists from across the UK and abroad have come together under a new banner, one committed to breaking Israel's blockade on Gaza. They call it the Global Samud Flotilla. Saif Aboukesh, the Global Samud Flotilla spokesperson, said, "What we are going to do next is to go in a mass movement of boats to break the seas." So dozens of boats going through different ports, mobilizing so many countries. There are 44 countries involved. This isn't the first time a flotilla will try to reach Gaza. The most recent one, the Handela, attempted to make it this week, only to be intercepted by the Zionist regime. The participants here, some of them from the Madalin ship, are commandeered by Israel, and they say the time is now different. Spokesperson for the flotilla group said, "When we look at the history of anti-colonial struggle, we see that once the people are decided to walk this long road to freedom, they don't stop. There's no oppressive regime that can put an end to it." Caigo Avila, a Brazilian activist who was aboard the Madalene aid ship, taken into custody by Israeli authorities, said, "So the Zionist regime has shown its true face to everyone by stopping two consecutive humanitarian missions carrying life-saving aid. But they did what they had to do because we still didn't have the organizing power, enough power to take to the streets simultaneously. There will be many, many boats now, and the conditions are changing." Organizers said that Israel is preparing to commit a war crime in the middle of international waters. One former civil servant and lawyer, Madeline Schweitzer, told reporters, "Of course, it's solidarity and love and a deep belief in a better world, that we also do not want to accept the things that they are, the status quo. We don't want to accept how our governments are separating and dividing us and think that it's this belief that we are possible." The collective powers allied with Israel turn their gaze elsewhere. Organizers of the Global Samud say they hope to set sail later this summer, saying that they hope the sea will be the road to freedom. at the Malcolm X Center in Bristol in the UK, a place named after a man who once said, "If you aren't ready to die for it, put the word freedom out of your vocabulary." That spirit of defiance and dignity is alive. The activists here say they believe that they can build a corridor of conscience to Gaza, come what may. A rights group reports that the resumption of aid airdrops in Gaza following months of widespread hunger crises fails to meet the minimum humanitarian needs and does not alleviate the catastrophe caused by Israel's deliberate starvation policy. In a statement released on Sunday, the human rights organization Euromed Monitor described the airdrops of aid into the Gaza Strip as yet another act of humiliation and degradation against Palestinians. According to the human rights group based in Switzerland, in Geneva, this initiative, approved by Israel and implemented on Saturday evening, does not signify genuine change in the humanitarian response. Rather, it aims to mislead international public opinion and downplay the severity of the situation, diverting attention from Israel's systematic starvation policy in the Gaza Strip, which has led to an unprecedented humanitarian catastrophe. The human rights group says that these actions reveal Israel's ongoing use of starvation as a primary tool to alleviate the population and to disseminate the population, undermining the means of survival. Euromed said, "This catastrophe is characterized by widespread famine, denial of food, water, and medicine, destruction of supply chains, obstruction of land-based aid delivery, and continued attacks on those seeking food. The reality on the ground shows that airdrop aid is scarce, randomly distributed, and poses significant risks. It frequently lands in densely populated areas, on displaced people's tents, in evacuated zones in areas under Israeli control, or in the sea, making it an unsafe and ineffective method from a humanitarian perspective. It endangers civilians crowded into less than 15% of the Gaza Strip, according to Euromed. With 2,300,000 Palestinians displaced into the small area due to Israeli control and forced evacuation orders, ethnic cleansing, air-dropped aid presents a serious risk to humanitarian aid and civilian lives amid severe overcrowding and the absence of areas that are safe."
Those reports are from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to look even harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report's been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I'm recuperating from a spinal injury, I'm staying in a house connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.